Today we're going to hear another panel discussion from the Bicentennial Women's Center. This is the first in a series of two programs devoted to the difficult issue of child custody. Today we will hear a panel discussion, and next week, Jennifer Baker Fleming from Women in Transition and Rosalie Davies from Custody Action Group for Lesbian Mothers will be here to discuss some specific problems facing mothers during a divorce action. For this second program, we invite you, the listener, to call in by phone and join our conversation. Now here's the panel from the Bicentennial Women's Center.
Women's Center. This is our sixth program that the Bicentennial Women's Center is co-sponsoring with the Public Committee for the Humanities in Pennsylvania, an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The topic for this evening's discussion is child custody and overview. The moderator, who is listed on our flyer, Sarah K. Cohen, is not able to be with us tonight, and so I am going to act as moderator. My name is Cynthia Little, and I'm the project director for this grant. We have four very interesting speakers here tonight who are going to give various different perspectives on the whole area of child custody, which is a problem that is becoming increasingly a part of American life as the divorce rate goes higher and higher, and also as we have changing social customs. Now, we have a time in which not just the mother is going to be asking for the children, but also the father. Not only that, but people previously who society completely denied any hope of having their children, people who are lesbians or male homosexuals now are also beginning to want their right to have custody to their children. I think you'll find this a really exciting panel. Each speaker will talk for 15 minutes, at which time I will cut them off very rapidly, so that we can go on to the next person. So we'll have an hour of formal presentations and then an hour of question and answer period between the panelists and the audience. Now, the first speaker for the evening is going to be Mike Simeon, who is an educator and a person who has a very special interest in the history of the evolution of the concept of childhood. Mike?
Mm-hmm. Most everyone has good feelings about children. We protect them, we cuddle them, we look forward to their growing up. We want to do well by them. The interesting thing is that this is a relatively new concept. Throughout most of Western history, people didn't feel this way about children. Many of the problems that we're going to be talking about tonight, the problems of child custody, are really problems caused by a concern for children. Parents want the best for their children. Father says he wants one thing, the mother says she wants something else. But it is a positive kind of concern. The whole notion of childhood is a modern concept, probably only around 400 years old. Until the end of the Middle Ages, around 400 years ago, there was really no separate stage called childhood. Children were infants until they were 6 or 7 years old, at which point they became little adults. At this point, they entered the adult world and were expected to carry on miniature versions of adult life. Actually, the only two things that they couldn't carry on were having children themselves and fighting in wars. Other than that, they were expected to carry the load. They were small men and women. They were not children. Actually, the 20th century is the first century that recognizes and guarantees childhood by requiring primary education. Now, it's very interesting that when we look through the historical record, that the history of childhood is really a nightmare. Children were not treated very well. The further we go back into antiquity, the worse they were treated. Adults seem to be using children over the years as an object of their unconscious desires and fears. They were acting out the aggressions that they felt about adults in their own life, and they took it out on their children. The historical literature is full of examples of this. We look at paintings of the period, we read diaries, we look at wood cuttings, and we see the problems that children had in just staying alive. Let me give you some examples of this. The most common abuse of children throughout the ages was beating. Children from the beginning were taught to fear the rod and to cry softly. when we look at the child-rearing tracts from the 18th century back, we find that all of them recognize the need for beating children, physically beating children. Some tracts give directions to salt and soak the child's body so that he would be able to handle beatings a little bit better, would toughen him up, harden him up. Children were swaddled, you know, the babe in swaddling clothes, as a way of keeping him under control, so that he could be hung in corners and tossed about without breaking things. There are countless examples of children who were tossed from window to window as playthings for adults and fell to their death. Another thing that we find throughout the ages is the problem of abandonment. Parents really didn't like to have children around. There's an example, you know, from the record of 21,000 children born in Paris in 1780. Only 700 of these 21,000 children were nursed by their mothers. Over 17,000 of them were sent into the country to be wet nursed by, in many cases, total strangers. Abandonment. Lack of concern for what happened to the infant child. We're all familiar with the phrases of beat the hell out of the child, scare the hell out of them. Well, during most of Western history, people believed that children were possessed by demons or were in danger of being possessed by demons. And one way of exorcising these demons was to scare the hell out of the child. So we have the spectacle of adults dressing themselves as monsters and shocking the child into a fright. Many of the fairy tales that have been handed down to us through the ages give examples of this, these active monsters in an attempt to scare the child. Corpses were used in the same way. Children were dragged out to public hangings. School children were brought out en masse and forced to watch hangings and watch the corpses rotting on the gallows. In many cases, they were beaten after these events so that they would remember it. Not a very, very pleasant picture of growing up in the Middle Ages. There are countless examples of sexual abuse. Granted, we have to put many of these stories into context, but until relatively recent times, children were not shielded in any way from the sexual behavior of their parents or from adults of any kind. Children were invited into the bed of their parents. Children were forced to take part in sexual activities of all sorts. It's not until fairly recently, the past 300 or 400 years, that children have been shielded from this kind of sexual abuse. Infanticide. We're relatively familiar with the problem of the murder of illegitimate children, but until recently, infanticide was practiced in most of Western society. In antiquity, in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, any census information that we have indicates that boys outnumbered girls 4 to 1, which indicates that many of the newborn female children were murdered to keep the number of females down. This persisted until the medieval times, where the census ratio appeared to be 2 boys to every 1 girl child. These are legitimate children. This is the murder of infants. So, without having to go over these horror stories some more, it's obvious that the lot of children has changed a great deal over the years. From earliest times where infanticide was practiced, through the period of abandonment during the Middle Ages, to a more ambivalent feeling of love-hate toward the children during the Renaissance, where the child on one hand was loved as the cult of the infant Jesus was developed. And we see in the Renaissance painting this romantic notion of children. But on the other hand, children were purged with enemas to exorcise the demons inside them. A more ambivalent feeling is beginning to develop. Then we see the 18th century develop a notion of training the child, toilet training, praying with the child, but not playing with him. On into the 18th century, where we began to see a socialization of the child that persists until the present. The child must be guided. He must be told what to do. He must be formed into an adult. And that brings us to the present, where we're still infected with this notion that we know what's best for the child. It's in the interest of the child that we make these decisions. All right, so where does this fit into American history? Well, America was settled in the 1600s at a time when the modern family was just beginning to develop in Western society. The family based on love rather than simply on authority is a relatively recent phenomenon. Around 1700, historians place the development of this modern family. The families that arrived here in the New World were extended families. There was no notion of child custody because great numbers of people lived in the same family, mother and father, grandparents, aunts, uncles, relatives of all sorts, including apprentices and servants and everyone else, an extended family. Someone was always around to take care of the child. All right, this progressed over the years until we reached the epitome of the nuclear family, the mother and father and children, in 1900. Here we have the romantic notion of the father sucking on his pipe on the porch with his children gathered around him and the mother knitting. And the family was obviously a blissful kind of romantic institution. No problem with child custody here because most families stayed together. So the problem of child custody is a 50-year phenomenon. As we saw the nuclear family from 1900 disintegrate into the family we have today. The sociologists are probably going to have to come up with new words to describe the kind of family constellations that we have in 1976. Child custody becomes a problem, becomes an issue now. But I would like the comments that you're going to hear from now on to be seen in this context, that as bad as things are today, and the horror stories that everybody can tell about child custody, that they pale in comparison to the treatment the children have gotten over the years.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Our next speaker is going to be Stuart Kaplan, who is a child psychiatrist in Philadelphia, and he's going to speak about the various traumas that both children and parents face at the time of a separation and divorce, and the types of therapy and consultation that is useful for both the parent and the child, both during the period of separation and then throughout the divorce, and then how all of them can function together well after a divorce has taken place. Stuart?
Thank you. The title of my paper is Children and Post-Divorce Family Relationships. As a child psychiatrist, it is often my task to assist families in the throes of divorce with helping their children through this painful psychological process. At the time of divorce, children are vulnerable to the well-described phenomena of grief, guilt, and cognitive misinterpretation of the event. Given a healthy child prior to the initiation of the separation, assisting them with these almost inevitable difficulties is a relatively simple matter. Unfortunately, it is often complicated by a variety of interpersonal difficulties that arise because each parent may change their behavior toward the child, and the parents may continue or intensify the ferocity of their assaults on each other. Thus, ongoing parental behaviors during and following the divorce are usually critical factors in the child's response to the divorce. Serious difficulties requiring professional help occur, and the conflict between the parents before the divorce continues unabated afterwards. The child may be used by the warring parents as a vehicle for the anger that each feels for the other. The legal fact of divorce or separation may not have any effect on the mutual rage between the parents. As the child is often their last remaining link, he provides a final and enduring opportunity for the spouses to express their vindictiveness. Unfortunately, the adversary system of divorce law tends to enhance the combativeness between divorcing parents rather than diminishing it. The opportunities to hurt each other through the child are limited only by the imagination of the combatants. They include speaking ill of the divorced spouse, picking a child up late or dropping them off early or late after visitation, not being present to receive a child at the end of a visitation period, delaying support payments, using the child to convey messages between the former spouses, and most simply, having an enormous battle at the time the child is exchanged for visitation. The use of the child in these and other ways as a weapon in these post-divorce marital battles leaves the child at best dismayed and perplexed. He may fervently wish that his parents would stop it, or he may choose a side and participate in the battle with one parent against the other. Another alternative is for the child to feel torn between each of the parents, at one moment siding with one, but quickly siding with the other and back again. The post-divorce marital battles appear to be something over which the parents have little conscious control. Although these couples are often well-educated, psychologically sophisticated, and possess an impressive degree of maturity in a number of areas, a mere reminder of their former spouses may be enough to enrage them and lead them to behave in ways that are infantile and obviously injurious to the psychological well-being of their children. There are two assumptions in the foregoing discussion. One assumption already mentioned is that psychologically marriages do not end with a legal divorce. At least this is often the case with post-divorce problems that come to my clinical attention. The hate, rage, blame, fault-finding, and capacity for mutual bickering can continue unabated by time and lawyers. Similarly, there is often an unacknowledged reservoir of mutual positive feelings between divorced spouses. My impression is that the positive feelings are most strong in those divorced spouses who continue to struggle most fiercely. The second assumption is that the parent who does not have custody of the child remains a critically important figure in the child's life. Goldstein, Freud, and Solnit, in a recent book on child custody that has already become a classic, quote, Beyond the Best Interests of the Child, note the absent parent cannot provide, quote, a true object for love, trust, and identification, since this role is based on his being available on an uninterrupted day-to-day basis, quote, rather unquote. My own position is diametrically opposed to this. I believe that the parent who does not have custody, but who maintains contact with the child through visitation, remains critically important to the child, and that the child remains vitally important to such a parent. First, as I have already endeavored to make clear, the parent who does not have custody can remain engaged in post-divorce marital conflict with his or her former spouse, and that this relationship is fraught with hazard for everyone involved. More importantly, there is considerable benefit to be gained for the child and the parent who does not have custody for maintaining contact with each other. One of the greatest fears of a child of divorce is that he is losing his parent. The parent who does not have custody has moved out and thus appears to be lost because he or she is no longer living with the child on a daily basis. This immediately raises in the mind of the child the fear that he may also lose the parent with whom he is currently living. However, if the child continues to see the parent who does not have custody on a regular basis and maintains a positive relationship with that parent, it can begin to occur to the child and may be pointed out verbally that the child has not lost the parent as he imagined, but that his parents will always remain his parents. This is enormously reassuring to a child of divorce if borne out by the reality of his life. The parent who does not have custody is also deeply concerned with the loss of his or her children, and maintaining a relationship with them is most reassuring to the parent. While many parents who do not have custody with time and new families of their own tend to drift from their children of a previous marriage, this abandonment is often a source of pain, shame, and guilt to them. Furthermore, children who have not seen that parent for several years can easily be moved to tears when asked to discuss them. This type of psychological pain is not a necessary condition of divorce. It can be avoided but the recognition of both parents or the continued importance of the parent who does not have custody in the psychological life of the child. They can both promote the continuing relationship with the parent who does not have custody. And what is the relationship between the parent who does not have custody with the child? There are a myriad of possibilities, but I will note one that is positive and not what might be expected. This is that the relationship may improve post-divorce compared to what it was pre-divorce. Those parents who may have become preoccupied with their career goals and over the years have come to have taken their children for granted, they find that once their relationship with their child is called into question by divorce, that they will take new interest in the welfare of their children and in the relationship that they have with them. Furthermore, for example, in those marriages in which the mother had formed an alliance with their children against the father, post-divorce visitation with the father, without the interfering presence of the mother, often provides a new opportunity for a healthier interaction. Having discussed the relationship between the parent who does not have custody with the child, I would like to briefly consider the relationship between the parent who does have custody with the child. In the cases that have come to my clinical attention, there is a tendency for whatever shortcomings existed in the parent-child relationship prior to the divorce to be exacerbated by the divorce. With the enormous stress of the divorce, which includes grief over the lost spouse and may include a complete reorientation to social life, educational, and vocational goals, it may challenge the spouse's very self-definition. It is no great mystery that children can tend to get lost. Those mothers who tended to be neglectful at times prior to the divorce with no great harm to the children may find that they must ignore them even more at a time when the children are most needful of them. Also, the children, as a result of the increased stress placed upon them, may become transiently more defiant and more demanding. As a result, they may be considerably less pleasant to be with. It is difficult to imagine a more stressful period in modern life than the recently divorced mother who must care for children. She requires and deserves a variety of psychological and social supports from family, friends, and the type of groups represented here tonight. What should one expect if a decision is made to seek professional help? First, I must make clear that I am describing my own approach to therapy. Professional approaches to this area that we are discussing vary considerably from practitioner to practitioner. First, there must be a diagnostic assessment to answer some of the following questions. Is this a healthy child who is simply responding to the situation of divorce with the expectable amount of grief and unhappiness, or is this a child who is clearly disturbed prior to the divorce, and the event of divorce in his life is relatively unimportant compared to the magnitude of his pre-existing psychological disturbance? What was the pre-divorce relationship between the parents, and what was the pre-divorce relationship between the parents and the child? How does this compare to the post-divorce relationship between the parents and between the parents and child? In many cases, the disturbed post-divorce relationship between parents and between parents and child is identical to the pre-divorce relationship. Psychologically, it is as if the divorce has not taken place. This type of situation requires more effort to resolve than a situation in which relationships between parents and child were healthy prior to the divorce but soured following the divorce. Who to see in treatment and in what combinations poses a difficult area in which to be precise about, as it very much depends on a given clinical situation. I usually choose to work with those individuals who have the greatest influence on the child's current life. This may be grandparents, parent and child, or divorced spouses and child, or simply a divorced spouse and child, or spouse individually or child individually. All of these combinations may be employed at various points during a given course of therapy. And what combinations are these groupings seeing? Again, this very much depends on the clinical situation and the goals of a given treatment or the goals of a given treatment session. The general notion is to assess the relationship between these family members and to support what seems to be promoting the child's growth and to shift those relationships that are disturbing to the child so that they again facilitate his growth. Spatial distance is a convenient metaphor to schematically indicate the relationship changes brought about by treatment. Excessive distance between parent and child suggests a need for the therapist to create closeness between them, while excessive closeness indicates that creating distance between parent and child might be helpful for both. The child might be freed from post-divorce conflict between parents by providing the parents a means of communication other than the child. In this situation, the goal is not to promote psychological closeness between the parents, but rather to give them a channel of communication besides the child. This channel may range from meeting together with the therapist to simply leaving messages with each other's secretary. That another channel of communication exists between the parents relieves the child of the burden of bearing messages for the family, and it often relieves him of symptoms as well.
Thank you, Stuart. Our next speaker will be Jennifer Baker Fleming, who is with Women in Transition in Philadelphia. Women in Transition is an organization that helps women who are going through the process of separation and divorce to get emotional, legal, consultations and help. Jennifer?
Thank you. I'm not sure exactly where to start. I'd like to comment on a few things that have been said so far and also speak from my particular perspective, which is trying to provide support to women who are separating or divorcing or who are being physically abused by their husbands. Women in Transition has been around for about 5 years, and when we first began operating the program, we concentrated primarily on providing emotional support to women in transition. But we found that the legal needs that women had were overwhelming and were not being met by the legal establishment. So we also instituted a paralegal component. So when a woman calls us with a child custody problem, we have a two-pronged approach to providing her with the support that she needs. One is to give her the legal information that almost all women are lacking regarding her situation within the custody battle. And the other is to try and provide her with some positive feelings about the trauma and the trial that she's going through. First of all, I want to speak a little bit about the emotional problems that women face in a child custody situation. Number one, women are conditioned to define themselves through motherhood. What that means for many women is when the divorce takes place and there is conflict over who the children are going to be with, many women feel what they consider to be their very identity slipping away from them. I think this is a major factor that contributes to the bitterness and the fighting that you mentioned earlier, Stuart, in that women who are overly possessive and are clutching of their children during the transition period often are women who define themselves solely through the home, women who have not functioned outside of the home over a period of time, or women who have been really totally wrapped up in their children, who see their success in life based upon how successful their children are going to be. And I think that one of the things that would contribute greatly to a reduction of the bitterness and the fighting over children would be for the surrounding culture to encourage women to define themselves as total, more round, whole, complete people. And I think when that happens, women will not be quite as desperate in their attitudes towards their children. A lot of the battling, I think, goes on for the same reason. As far as the father's behavior is concerned, many fathers, I think, will petition for custody. I've seen this happen over and over again, when they don't really want it, but they petition for it because they know that that's one way to get to the wife, through the children. Women are always vulnerable around their children, always vulnerable around motherhood. So many men will try to take the children away, or will take the children away, simply to punish the mother. And one of the things that we try and help women deal with when they find themselves in that situation is the need for them to have confidence in themselves as people and as parents, and to recognize that if such is the case and the father is petitioning for custody without really wanting the children, that eventually the children will come to know that, and that eventually the father will tire of the responsibility that he's taking on, and will, oftentimes the woman will end up regaining her children in a situation like that after 6 months or a year. As far as discrimination is concerned, I think that there's a myth in this culture. And the myth is that, number one, women always win child custody battles and always get their kids. And the second myth is that they're automatically better suited to parent than the fathers are. The first myth was a myth that I myself, I think, subscribed to when I first started working at Women in Transition. And it wasn't until I had talked to hundreds of women who had lost their children in child custody battles that I began to realize that the image that we have of the judge awarding the children to the mother, no matter how unfit she may be, if she's an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever, is really not what's happening. That women go on trial when there's a child custody battle, and they go on trial in ways that men do not. For example, a woman's sex life, her sexual behavior, is brought up in court as a yardstick of her ability to mother. For example, I know of many women who have been in child custody battles who have had neighbors testify against them to the effect that, well, there was, I saw a man go into her house on such and such a night and not come out till the next morning. So what happens is that while the father's sexual activities are never even discussed, unless they are blatantly obscene, the mother's sexual behavior is considered a yardstick of her total character. And if she does not meet what I call the Virgin Mary image of what American womanhood is supposed to be in the minds of the male, old, white, middle-class judges that make these decisions, then she has a problem.